This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hello, everyone, from around the world, and thanks for joining us on another great episode of Baseball Outside the Box, the show that brings you the most innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds who love to challenge the status quo. And I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. First of all, special thanks to our producer, Brian Kroc, with the Lineup Media Group. And don't forget, go to lineupmediagroup.fm and listen to all the great podcasts in all kinds of different fields. It's a leading podcast company in the world. And join us on Twitter at Baseball Out and Facebook, Baseball Outside the Box. For your new listeners, thank you for listening. Join the show. Go to baseballoutsidethebox.com. Hit iTunes or Stitcher. Join. You'll get updates on the new shows every time they're up. So we hope that you will do that. And for our loyal listeners, thank you very much. You keep the show going. If you get a chance, also go to iTunes and Stitcher. If you love the show, give us a 5-star rating. That helps us continue to show and get it out there. So your help is greatly appreciated. All right, listen, today's show, we're going to talk about a couple different topics. First of all, we're going to talk about, you know, a little bit about the statistics in the game, the science in the game, and how that can be used at certain levels, and sometimes how it can be misused at certain levels. So we're going to be talking about that. And we're going to talk, also get into pitching, because the statistics do relate in the pitching. We're going to talk about arm injuries and how to overcome them. We've got a great guest today who's been through some, you talk about tough times. He's been through not just one, but two Tommy John surgeries. And we are going to talk to him about, you know, how he overcame them. He became an all-star both times. So we're going to tell you about Dan Blewett. Dan is a professional. He pitched for 6 years in professional baseball for several clubs. He started then the Warburg Academy. He's a pitching coach. He has his own podcast called the Dear Baseball Gods. As I mentioned, had two Tommy John surgeries. He's written a book about his tumultuous, difficult career in baseball. We're going to talk about his book and see how we can get a copy of that. I think that'd be a great book for everybody. He went to school at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, degree in arts, and he's a double major in the field of philosophy and psychology. He's a certified national strength and conditioning coach. He authors many articles in collegiate baseball, TNation.com, bodybuilding.com, stack.com, eliteFTS.com, and his first book on Amazon titled Pitching Isn't Complicated. Boy, we're going to love hearing about that one. So first of all, let me introduce our guest, Dan Blewett. Dan, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, Pete. Doing well. Doing well.
Hey, listen, I know you've got a lot going on. I checked out your websites. I want our audience to know that, you know, you and I have been kind of talking a little bit through, you know, whether it's Facebook or Twitter and kind of communicating. You were nice enough to contact me and tell you about, you know, tell me about your career. And then I was very honored to be able to see you speak at the Illinois High School Coaches Clinic, which you did a fantastic job. So I want our audience to understand that you're also a national speaker. You get asked to speak a lot. Matter of fact, you'll be speaking at the ASMI conference coming up pretty soon. So first of all, again, thanks for being on the show, and then we'll get started, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Well, tell our audience, what did I miss, first of all? Anything else that you have been doing that you want our, you know, the audience to know? We got audience all over the world that you want them to know that you're doing in the game of baseball.
You know, last weekend, so you got it, just missed the date by just a week. I spoke at the ASMI Injuries in Baseball course this past weekend. And, you know, that was just a really big honor because that course is a big deal. It's run by Dr. James Andrews, Dr. Glenn Fleissig, and just features some of the best minds in baseball. You know, you get to listen to the team surgeons, the team athletic trainers. There's just so many great minds there. And for me to be able to share my story with all of them and kind of give them the patient side, you know, it was really special because to me it felt like a chance to give back and a chance to sort of thank everyone in the industry for helping my career, you know, extend. Because I got so many great memories And, you know, as I look back at it, there's nothing that I would change. You know, I think a lot of people who've had hardship in their journey, they feel the same way, that it ends up defining who you are and how you respond to those, you know, those tough times. So that was a big privilege from last week. And then obviously you and I met the previous week at the Illinois High School Baseball Coaches Association. And, you know, that was a really fun talk. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you covered pretty much all of it. The one big thing that I'm excited about is I'm creating online courses now. My first one just launched is called The Ace of the Staff. And I think it's serving an underserved market, which is there's not a lot of guys out there talking about their experience in baseball and how to actually pitch and compete and get through some of these situational aspects that are so important. Because, you know, once you get to minor league baseball, everyone throws hard. Everyone has great, you know, devastating sliders and all this stuff. What gets guys to the majors or not is their baseball savvy, their baseball acumen, how smart they are. You know, how do they go through their game and decide what pitch is the most effective to throw? How do they control these situations and control the running game? And it ends up being all the little details that make a guy the ace or a guy who doesn't make it. And so that's what my newest online course covers. And I'm just excited to start putting stuff out there because, as you know, media is changing. I don't know that kids are real apt to read a baseball book, even if it's, mm-hmm. you know, about their passion, whether it's pitching or hitting or whatever. And so this is, it's in like a narrated PowerPoint format and a lot of videos and talks. And it's, I think, a lot more interactive. And I've learned a ton from online courses as I learned to use some of these software programs like Adobe Photoshop and, InDesign. So like, I think online learning is changing. And so, you know, I think all these sort of baseball products are going to change as we go forward. So that's my only other, passion project at the moment. But other than that, I appreciate the introduction.
No, that's fantastic. And we will get your online course on our show notes. So folks, you'll be able to see that. That's fantastic. You're doing that. I think that will be great for a lot of our audience around the world to join you on the online course. And the other one, you know, I was going to mention was, you know, ASMI, you know, for you to be able to go there and speak, I agree. I mean, our audience, you got a pretty good understanding. Not only has Dan gone through a lot, but he's also overcome a lot, and he specializes in these areas and how to overcome these injuries. So for him to be able to be asked to speak at ASMI, that is a big deal. I agree. We had Dr. Fleissig on the show not too long ago. So that's why I'm glad to have you on. And here's the battle I had, Dan. The battle okay. I had a little bit thinking was, all right, do I start off with the two Tommy John surgeries, how you prevailed and all that, or do I start off with the science of the game? And I had to go with the injury part first because it is so important for our audience to understand it. You know, kids, players, and coaches all over the world need to know, you know, how they possibly can, you know, reduce the ability to get, you know, Tommy John surgery or a major surgery. But let's start off with this. Let's start off first. Tell our audience, one, you know, why do you believe you went through this process of getting two Tommy John surgeries? Because that could help many people out there understand this.
Well, you know, if you look back at my injury history, I first injured my elbow when I was a sophomore in high school. I had a partial UCL tear, which, you know, the UCL is the ligament they reconstruct in Tommy John surgery. Mm-hmm. And then I had elbow problems for the rest of my high school career, and I didn't pitch a lot. I just, my arm would kind of feel dead, kind of in like the bicep, tricep area. And I really struggled just to rebuild myself as a high schooler. I got a chance to play college baseball. I was a walk-on. And I think my special talent was that I had this hammer curveball. When my coach came to recruit me, he said it was the best curveball he'd seen in 20 years. And I threw 80 miles per hour, but he said that curveball could get guys out in Division I. But I need to get a lot better. I need to throw harder. I need to improve my command if I was going to get any innings with them. So I happily said yes and took my chances. And at that point, you know, my switch kind of flipped and I kind of realized, like, hey, I got really lucky here. And I probably didn't deserve to play college baseball. It was always my passion. And I think I felt like a lot of young players feel is like that I was really good, but where are the scouts? Why aren't they coming to watch me? I just really didn't know what I didn't know. And I didn't really know that I wasn't really that good in the grand scheme of things. And that was a wake up call for me. So from that point on, I became this gym rat. I did everything my coaches told me to do. I asked what more they had for me. I studied nutrition. I bought nutrition textbooks off Amazon. I I became a certified personal trainer as a sophomore in college just because I wanted to learn all that stuff, not because I wanted to train anyone yet. And, you know, I started to throw harder. By the end of my freshman year, I was 84 to 87. And, you know, every year I came back a better version of myself. And that was always my goal, that no matter what happened, I wanted to not waste a single day. And every year that I came back in the fall, I wanted to be a significantly better pitcher than I was the previous year. And when I looked back, like I could, I was. And so I don't know why I was always injured. So my sophomore year in college, I had a partial tear. And it was tough. And then that was my junior year. And then my redshirt junior year, which is my fourth year in college, I fully tore it at the very end of the season on the mound in the conference tournament. And, so I'll tell you a little bit about that day before I kind of go back into why I think I was hurt and what I could improve on. But so as I started that season, it was an exciting year. So that fall, I had kind of like broken through. I was 89 to 91. We had a scout day every fall. And when I threw in that scout day, scouts were actually interested. And they followed up on me. And one of the teams, especially the Rockies, they brought one of their big, their higher up scouts to come and sit down with me and do one of those long questionnaires. And it was just such an exciting time. And they told my coach basically, like, yeah, we like Dan. He's got a lot of good two seam movement. He's, you know, 89, 91, sometimes 92. And all he really needs to do in the spring is pretty much throw the way we saw him throw in the fall. And so this whole winter, I was just so excited. And I just was also very anxious trying to hope. It's like, what if my velocity goes away? Because I'd never thrown that hard before and I didn't want it to like magically disappear. But so the season approached, and as the season got going, I started to have forearm cramping and my forearm started to tighten up maybe like the sixth inning and the seventh inning. And then, you know, then it would start to happen a little bit faster, fifth inning, fourth inning. And we went to spring break in March, and we were pitching in Florida. And I remember like a lot of those teams that saw me in the fall were, they were coming out to watch me. And I just remember this day we were playing Eastern Kentucky on this big high school complex, but it was like a beautiful, you know, Florida, you know, high school fields are like college fields. And I just remember seeing all the scouts, there were like 15 of them there probably in my first inning. And by the fourth inning, they all left. And I asked my teammates afterward, I said, you know, how hard was that thrown? Did you see? And they're like, yeah, you're like 86, 87, 88. And my heart just sank. And I just started to know, like, my forearm was tightening up. It was cramping. Like, something wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And so I battled that for most of the season. I didn't miss any starts until towards the end. And I think I got a week and a half off for the conference tournament. And I was feeling good. And I was, my velocity jumped back up. I was 89 to 92, and I was pitching the first game because I was the number one on our team in the conference tournament. It's our first conference tournament bid in a long time, and we were facing off against now big leaguer Tom Kohler. He's pitched well for the Marlins. He's had a pretty good career with them. And so there were a lot of scouts in the stands. I mean, it was pretty packed. Most of them were there for Tom, but that's how, you know, look, little guys like myself get discovered. You know, they're there to watch him, but they had their guns fixed on me just the same. And it was like it was the sixth inning, and I noticed because there were two outs, and I think we had two runners on base, and I was just trying to finish this runner off, and we were down, I think, 4-1. And I throw him a curveball, and I feel this vibration like shoot down my arm. And it wasn't a pain, but it was almost like if my arm was like a guitar, someone just like strummed it all at once. I said, okay, you know, I'd been through the gamut of elbow problems. I'd felt all the different types of pain and soreness and cramping and like any like sensation like I'd had it in my elbow, but that one was new. And I just remember standing on that mound as I backed off and kind of rubbed the ball. I looked up into the forest. It was, you know, it was dark. We were playing at Farmingdale College, and it's kind of set back into the wilderness a little bit. And I looked up into these trees, and I just felt this impending doom. Just like you'd poked a bear or something and you know it's about to like turn back around and come after you. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'm going to throw this next pitch. I know that much, and I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to throw this next pitch. So I got back up there, and I threw a fastball. I threw as hard as I could, and that same sensation. I said, okay, well, two in a row, it's not painful. you know, what's happening? So I kept battling. I just wanted to get off that mound. I didn't know what was going on, but I just wanted to get off that mound without anyone knowing that anything had happened. And so I'm throwing to this guy, fastball fouls it off, curveball fouls it off, curveball fouls it off. I call my catcher out. I said, hey, have you noticed anything different? Am I throwing slower? Or like, and he's like, no, like you seem okay. I said, okay, well, I felt something in my elbow and I don't know what's going on, but, you know, let's try to just get this guy out and, you know, we'll figure it out in the dugout. And fouls it off, fouls it off, foul. He's just battling. And I'm just cursing this guy because it's like, please just get out already. Just let me win this and I can get into the dugout. Finally, he hits this like 19 hop ground ball right down the third base line, sneaks it in, rolls in the corner for a double, scores both the runners on base. And then at that point, I just knew. I didn't really know where the ball was going. With every pitch, I just got a little wilder, and I called my coach out, and I pointed at my elbow. And that was how my college career ended. Hmm. And, you know, the disappointment, it's hard to describe when you see all the scouts up there watching you, and you're throwing a very good game. You know, through that 5 2/3, I was pitching pretty well. I struck a bunch of guys out, was commanding the zone, and it was a big moment for our college in general, and it was our first conference tournament bid. And just to walk off like that, and that was the last pitch I ever threw in college. And so, you know, I saw my doctor a couple weeks later, and he said, you know, we got another standard MRI, and he said, you know, I'm not convinced it's fully torn. If you want to try to rehab this again, we can. And so we did. I didn't want to get the surgery if I could avoid it, so we tried to rehab again. At the end of that summer, I got back on the mound. And he said, basically, you have to rehab without pain. If you have any pain, you got to come back in here. We're going to get surgery. But he said, you got to give it a fair shot. So you can't go up on the mound and hold back. You got to go up there and you have to give it your all. So I got back on that mound. I remember we were at the University of Maryland, and I was getting ready to go in the game. I had not had any pain yet. But as I was warming up in that game, I was like, look, you got to do this. So I was throwing as hard as I could throw it, and I started to feel a little bit of pain. And at that moment, I knew, and I jogged out and I went up to the mound anyway. When I got up there to throw my first warm-up pitch on the mound, it was just like dagger, 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 just stabbing my elbow with every pitch. And so finishing that inning was tough. I was in a lot of pain. You know, you start to recoil because when you extend, that's when it really hurts. And I knew that that was it for me. That was the last, you know, I'd be on that mound. So
now let me ask you, because you then went through Tommy John surgery right after this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I got August of that year.
Yeah, because I want our audience to understand, you know, you went through Tommy John, and now you had to go through rehab. Explain the rehab a little bit, the process, because I'm sure it's not an easy rehab. And then all of a sudden you had it again, and then you had to go through rehab again. Because both times, you know, I read that you became an all-star, you came back stronger. So explain that a little bit, because I want our young players and coaches to understand, you know, that getting Tommy John surgery is not something that is good for you. And two, it's going to take a ton of rehab also.
Yeah. So I got it in August, and the tough time about getting in August is that you're pretty much not going to make the next season. So it's going to take you 2 full years before you can come back. So, you know, in the first 4 months, it's really slow and it's really dull. You know, you can't lift weights for the first, you know, six or eight weeks, I think. And then really you're just doing very mundane forearm exercises, rotator cuff exercises. You're just doing very basic, boring stuff, and you can't touch a ball for the first 4 months. And now they're starting to extend it longer, so they don't want guys to throw as much till 5 or 6 months. And the tougher part about all that is just being away from the game. You just forget, you know, you miss it, and it just, you can feel that it doesn't wait for you. And that's the big thing. I mean, I've heard some parents think that, oh, my son should just get the surgery so that he can just be, you know, it'll help him come back better and stronger. And that's a myth. No one, you don't come back stronger unless you weren't doing things that you should have been doing all along. So the rehab makes guys come back throwing harder. And I was no exception. You know, I was 89 to 91, 92 at my best prior to surgery, and I was 91 to 94 after. But that was because I did so much more rehab. You learn to be more disciplined. You know, you learn to really care about your body and be more regimented and professional about what the way you do things. So people come back throwing harder only because they didn't do all the arm care or the strength training before surgery, you know, yeah. So they figure it out. And so, you know, months 6 through 12, it's really tough because you're throwing bullpens, you're lifting weights like a normal person again, you're doing all your arm care still, and all those different things stress your elbow out. So your elbow gets sore, it gets irritated, and you're like, okay, do I throw less? Do I lift less? Like, how much do I lift? Like, what do I not do? It's really tough to taper up and down all the different things that you're doing to get you back, because you have to rehab, you have to get strong again. You have to get your whole body strong, not just your arm. And it becomes really difficult to balance how much you can do while you're, you know, adding speed, adding new pitches back into your repertoire at like month 7, 8, 9. And mm-hmm. It's complex, especially that bullpen phase where you're getting close to throwing full speed again. It gets really complex because your elbow reacts to everything new that you do. And it takes a lot of patience, and it's mentally exhausting. You know, for me, it was, like I said, I got August surgery. So August through August the next year, and then I was making my comeback to baseball in May. So it was a solid 21 months of being away from the game. Yeah.
You know, and it sounds like you said it perfectly. It sounds like, boy, it's really a mental game when it comes to sitting out a whole year. But then you came back, you became an all-star, you came back, pitched again, got Tommy John surgery again, and now had to go through another rehab. Is the question would be here, especially for our young players, looking back, hindsight, what's your recommendation for young kids so that way they could at least, you know, you're never going to avoid an injury 100% possibly, but what to reduce the injuries, what's some of your recommendations that you would recommend the young players and coaches to follow when it comes to pitching especially?
Yeah, so, you know, with the culmination of everything, you know, I became an all-star after, you know, my third year pro ball, and then after my second surgery, I became an all-star again. And I know at the very end that I could have pitched in the major leagues. I was good enough. I played with a lot of guys who'd been there. Like, I knew that I could have. And so at that point, you say, if I had stayed healthy, would I have pitched in the big leagues? You know, would I have been there if I got those 4 years back? And so that's what I think a lot of young kids don't realize, is that it really derails your career. And even though I wouldn't trade my experiences for anything, I might have pitched in the big leagues if I hadn't gotten both those surgeries. You never know. You don't know where your path would have taken you. But I know at one point I was good enough, but it was just too late for me, you know, my injury history and all that. So my recommendation is that if you're a young kid, you just have to take stock that you're not immortal, and that your body is your temple. So I watched this documentary on Warren Buffett, and he asked this group of kids, he said, you know, what if you could pick out any car in the world that you want, and you could have it, but it was the only car you would ever own? What would you do? He said, you would take really good care of that car, wouldn't you? You'd get the oil changed, you would take really good care of it. Well, your arm is the only arm you're ever going to get. And mm-hmm. if you're not at home doing arm care, doing some of that mundane rotator cuff and forearm exercise strengthening, if you're not focused on your strength and conditioning and doing quality repetitions with, you know, good range of motion, just focusing on your technique and your form, you're not taking good care of that one arm that you're going to get. And you never know how good you might be. I mean, I've seen kids jump up 5-10 miles per hour in a year some years, and they could pitch in the majors someday. But if they don't take care of their arm early, they're going to put so much wear and tear on it during those years that it's going to end up failing them later on. And so you just have to start young. You have to be diligent. You don't have to make it a job when you're a young kid, but you need to put some time in, because for the guys that don't take care of their arm, it's 100% injury risk. I mean, you're going to get injured. It's not a question of when, but or I'm sorry, of if you will, but of when you will.
Mm-hmm. Dan, let me ask you, is when you kept throwing, you know, in the old days, you know, when I was young, you know, they just, you know, if you had some pain, they just told you throw through it. Did you feel that throwing through it and not saying anything, or maybe, you know, not mentioning it earlier or getting out earlier and checking it better, were those some in the areas that caused possibly, you know, to have the surgery?
Yeah. So, and I mentioned this in my speech at ASMI, there were 5 moments where I was in so much pain in the bullpen that I like basically like crossed my heart, you know, hope to die as I go out to the mound. Like I made peace with my career before I jogged out those nights. And two of those five times I was right. And I walked off the mound with, you know, a busted elbow, you know, and you can't pitch through pain when you're a young kid. You know, when you're in pro baseball, unfortunately, it's very cutthroat game. And sometimes you feel like you can't, there's no other way out. You feel like you can't tell them that you're hurting because you'll get off their good list, or you might not get that promotion that you want or whatever. But as a young kid, you have to think long term. And by young kid, I mean anyone who's under like 25. You know, if you're a young player, you're an amateur player, you have to take care of your arm. And that means speaking up. So if your coach is wants you to go that extra inning and says, okay, you say, okay, I'll dig deep and I can do this. And the other thing, you know, you have to say no. You have to say, coach, you know, I'm tired. But Pete, it's such a hard thing because sure. I know even on my teams, I don't want a kid who's going to say, hey, coach, I'm tired, take me out. I don't want that kid. But I tell my players, you have to tell me because I want you to want to go back out even when you're tired, but I don't want to do it to you. So it's really the coach's decision. He has to take the ball from the player because we're such a competitive breed, you know, ball players. And sure. If you're never going to make it to the majors if you don't want to go back out. But when you know that you probably shouldn't, when you know your arm's tired, when you know your arm's hurting, you have to speak up because you have to think of the you 5 years from now or the you 10 years from now. Do you want to keep pitching or do you want to sacrifice those great, amazing years because you pitched one too many innings over and over and over in your youth or in your amateur days? You know, you have to speak up. You have to be communicative with your coach. And coaches, you have to take the ball from your players. You can't ask them, can they give you one more? I don't know that I've ever turned down a coach when he said, can you give me one more? I don't think I ever did one time, not once.
Exactly.
So it's got to be the coach.
And the more information the coach has, the better decision he can make. So it doesn't help anybody if you're hurting and you're on the mound and the coach doesn't know it. And, you know, he thinks maybe you can get through this next hitter. I mean, that could cost you an injury just by staying in the game. It could cost the team issues also. So I would assume honesty is always the best policy. And folks, so you know, you can go to @CoachDanBlewett, BLEWETT. He's on Twitter. Get a lot of great information there from Dan and also his website, danblewett.com. Check it out, man. It's awesome stuff there. Dan, we're going to continue here because when I was reading your some of your information, you talked about your hard work. You have a podcast that, you know, you've started that talks about, you know, your story, but also interviews I've noticed some great people in the game and some great areas of the game of development. But you did mention one word that I really like, and I want you to kind of emphasize what you mean by this. You said in, you know, everything you've gone through, of course you had hard work, you resolved, but you also had to have grit. Explain to our young players out there what you mean by grit.
Yeah, so I think grind is a really popular hashtag. Mm-hmm. But I don't think most players know what it means to have grit, and they don't know what it means to really grind. So, you know, grit to me is when someone says that you can't, you deep down, you say that I know that I can, and I'm going to prove it to you. Mm-hmm. And then in every step of your day, you go about your business, putting in more work than the next guy to make sure that that happens. And it's also about insulating yourself to the negativity and just to the daily grind that we all go through as players. And, you know, I didn't learn what the grind was until pro baseball, because when you start to play 140 games in 156 days, you learn that you're not going to be healthy every day. Most days you don't feel very good. And then the question is, can I still give my team winning innings even when I don't feel my best? Because the guys that don't have grit, they make excuses when they don't feel their best. You know, they don't turn in their best performances when they're tired or they got no sleep on the team bus last night or, you know, they're sick. You know, you go through all this, and when you're a pro, you're expected to perform. No one cares one bit what your excuse is. No one cares if you're sick. If you say you can pitch, you pitch, and you pitch at 100%. And so for me, you know, I always had a lot of grit in that I was just going to put my head down and I was going to do my job. And I took a lot of pride in doing my job well. No matter what it was, I was going to try to do my best to do what was asked of me, whether I felt sick or I was healthy or I was hurting, or even if I was, my elbow was hanging by a thread. And grit is just, can you get back up? Can you just keep going? Can you give one more really great effort, really great focused, determined effort for your team and for everyone around you, even when you're not your best?
You know, and here's the part I also wanted to ask you. I know you've got some young players. You've got some teams that you coach in the competition at the young levels. Go back to the pitching part. I want to ask you, what's the main focus? And we'll end with this, and then I want to get into the second half on the statistics and science of the game. What do you emphasize with your young kids, with the young pitchers? What do you start with to make sure they get that correct before you start going on to other things?
You know, for me, I don't know that I'm old school, but I'm kind of old school. I don't believe in all this fancy stuff.
And you're not even old. Wait, you're not even old.
I know.
You're the new school, old school.
Yeah, I can possibly be old school, but I don't believe in flashiness. I don't believe in all these crazy drills just to kind of keep attention span. I believe in trying to teach kids how to be professionals at a young age, because I don't know when someone told me how to conduct myself and how to go through my pregame routine like a pro, but I figured it out along the way. And I think it was somewhere in my 20s. And for a 10-year-old kid, a 14-year-old kid, a 17-year-old kid to every day show up at the ballpark, kind of eat the same thing, get enough sleep, go through his stretching routine, go through his throwing routine with a set number of drills, a set number of throws, with a very strong focus on every single one. You know, you only get so many throws per year. You know, if you kind of track it out for the whole year, you probably get about 10,000 throws a year. And can you focus hard on every single throw so that you get something out of every throw? Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I learned in pro ball. As a reliever, you only get 30 throws pregame. You know, you're just playing catch with your buddy, you do a quick flat ground, and you're trying to feel something on every throw so that it helps you prepare for the game, even though you're not going to throw full speed until you get in the game itself. And at that point, you learn the value of every single throw. Can I get something out of my mechanics and my body? Can I feel what I need to feel on every single throw and get something out of it? It's an incredible attention to detail. And that's the biggest thing that I preach to young kids, because if you have a focus on everything that you do and you have a reason behind every pitch that you call, and you have attention to detail in everything that you do, you're gonna find more success than the next guy. And you're gonna find ways to be successful when hardship strikes, when you get promoted to a level and you struggle. You know, you can figure out solutions when you have that really high attention to detail. And so that's the bigger thing for me. You know, we do tons of stuff with mechanics and all that stuff. But for me, if I can get these young men to handle themselves like professionals, to keep an even keel, to be extremely highly focused on the details, then I think we're going to win a lot of ball games.
Yeah, everybody does say the game is mental, and then your background, obviously psychology major, you know, has got to be something that's really helped you with working with young players. Folks, we're going to get into the second half of the show because we promised you have two halves to this and two different discussions. Now, as I mentioned, I met Dan at the Illinois High School Coaches Convention. There, he gave a great talk on. We can't go over the whole thing that he gave because it was, 45 minutes to an hour talk there. But it was great on statistics, the science of the game related to the different ages. So, Dan, first of all, explain to our audience, how did you get started into the statistics, the sabermetrics, the spin rate issues and all the different things that you're here on MLB Network nowadays?
So my last couple years, I pitched in the Atlantic League. And they have a separate column of your stats because, I mean, you check your stats and you try not to focus on them too much as a player because they can kind of make you crazy. But they had a sabermetrics section. And so they had like 10 stats and, you know, there were numbers in there with my name. And I'm like, what do these things mean? And as I started to look them up and figure out what they meant, like there are things like ERC plus, which is like a new earned run quotient, which I actually don't use that very much anymore. Batting average for balls in play, which is all the balls that are hit into play except home runs or strikeouts. They had all these numbers for all of us. I'm like, what do these mean? So I started to look into them, and I also started to try to figure out who I was as a pitcher. So I covered two things in my talk. We covered StatCast data a little bit, which, you know, is kind of like the physics of the game. So the spin rate on fastballs, the spin rate on different pitches, like how they move, velocities, you know, the launch angle for hitters, that kind of stuff. And then there's sabermetrics, all the stats that are helping to evaluate players as accurately as possible. So as a pitcher, for example, I went at one point 10 straight innings and I didn't get a single ground ball out. And as I started to read about spin rate, they talk about how when you have a high spin rate fastball, hitters tend to swing underneath it and they tend to swing and miss more often and they tend to lift the ball up into the air. So as I'm just kind of like starting to learn about all this stuff, I'm like, that's me, you know, because I would throw 3-1 fastballs, 92 miles an hour, right down the middle to an ex-major leaguer and he'd miss it. And I'm like, how on earth did you just miss that pitch? Like, I don't throw 99. Like, there's, you have no business not killing that pitch. But guys just would like mythically, like they'd swing and miss on hitters' counts and just be like, they'd kind of like shake their head. And I'd be like, I don't know either. Like, I don't know why you missed that. Should have taken me deep. And then with all those fly balls, you start to realize, okay, I think there's something going on here. I think I'm a high spin rate pitcher. Now, how can I use that information to make me even better? So for me, it, you know, you hear this wisdom, which is valid wisdom for almost every pitcher, which is pitch down the zone. And you have to learn to pitch down the zone, because if you don't, all your breaking balls become sloppy. You don't learn to get it on top of the ball and really force it down. But for me, when I pitch down the zone, so if I threw a fastball at the bottom of the kneecap, it would rise up into their barrel and they would hit me hard. So all my extra base hits and home runs were pitches at about the knee. Whereas anytime I threw a fastball at the letters, they'd swing and miss or pop it up. Like, they couldn't hit me if I was at the letters or above. And so as you start to piece this together, you're like, okay, it seems like I'm a high spin rate pitcher. Some of these smart guys out there in baseball world, they say that high spin rate pitchers succeed up in the zone and they get hurt down the zone. And that's been my own experience as well. So I think as I'm making my game plan, I need to avoid the outside part of the plate and I need to avoid the bottom part of the zone with my fastball. And when I started to figure all that out, I became much more successful and I started to continue to get better as I got older, even though I had, you know, two surgeries and I didn't throw any harder at age 30 than I did at age, you know, 27. So, you know, with all this stuff, if a player's in tune with it, he can optimize his ability. He might not, you know, it might not change him as a player very drastically, but when every little bit counts, you know, it can matter a lot. So especially with young pitchers who don't know how to pitch, they don't know how to attack the zone in the right way, or they don't know how to optimize what they do well, you know, spin rate can be a really big, big help. Because you see guys who get tons of ground balls and they know that they are successful when they stay at the bottom of the zone. But guys like me are not successful the way they pitch. And you start to learn just who am I as a pitcher or who am I as a hitter? What can I do well and what can't I? So that was kind of how I got started with all that. And then, so, you know, with me as a baseball coach and as the owner of an organization, so my academy, Warbird Academy, we have six teams and we've grown every year. We'll probably go to 8 or 10 next year. Our teams are called the Warbird Senators. And I'm trying to figure out how to evaluate our players and how to help them succeed. So what can we learn with some of this data and what can we learn through some of the statistics that we keep on them to help them be better at their own job? You know, maybe we hit a kid in a different spot in the lineup because of certain stats, or maybe we bunt a kid more or less, or maybe he steals more or he doesn't, or maybe we change the batting order because, you know, kids A, B, and C are coming up and they do this well versus something else. So it's also just trying to help give kids a fair chance too. So I'll give you one example. Last year we had a kid on our top team who is a very good receiving catcher. He's a very good defensive catcher, but he's really undersized. I mean, compared to his peers, he was, you know, he's like a buck 25, buck 30, like really small kid for his age. But we put him on that team because we knew what a good receiver he was. So he struggled, you know, as you'd probably expect, playing on a really like top level 16U team. He struggled at the plate, but he has an incredible eye. I mean, like almost like a Joey Votto. I'm not sure anyone compares to Joey Votto, but his plate discipline was outstanding. And so as we looked through the box scores and through our stats through the first 30 games, I think he was hitting a like a buck 70. And so parents who had noticed this were kind of, you know, getting on. So like, why is he still starting? Why is he still playing? When we had another kid, another good catcher, not quite as good as him, you know, defensively, who was hitting, you know, 320. And they say, why isn't, you know, he should be on the bench. And first of all, we, you know, said, we appreciate your opinion, but, you know, we're running this.
Yeah.
But it was more than just batting average. So we looked through the stats, and what they didn't realize was that he had the third highest on base percentage of the team.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though he maybe had like 9 hits, he had 20 walks. And so this young man was on base, you know, almost as high as anyone on the team. And every time you get on base, you know, there's a value. So you score about 42% of the time in the majors when you get on first with no one out. And so the value of being on first base in Major League Baseball is a little more than a half a run. And so we look at this kid and we're like, okay, he's extremely valuable to us because he's getting on base. And when you get on base, you know, you're going to produce runs for your team. And that was kind of going back to the Moneyball thing, where In Moneyball, their team is successful because they were looking for high on base percentage players, you know, and now we have more stats that give more of the total picture than just on base percentage.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he was like a classic Moneyball kind of player where he's on base a ton. He's not going to get a ton of hits, at least yet. And he has grown this year. So we're excited about him because he's still going to have a great eye, but he's now physically capable too. And so he's a kid where you could just miss, you know, you could just say, this kid, he's not good enough. Let's cut him. But he deserved to be on that team. If you look at the stats a little bit of a different way, and that's what we're excited about, because he was a kid who, he's a gritty, strong, determined kid, and he deserves, you know, another chance to prove what he could do. He just was waiting to grow, you know?
Absolutely. And now, Dan, what other ways have you taken the stats? Because I love it. I mean, I think what's really changed the game a great deal is science and statistics for the better. What are some other areas that you've taken and used statistics for your young, and especially at the younger ages, to help them progress, whether it's pitching or hitting or any other area, fielding or actually the strategy of the game? Any of the other areas that you've used that kind of can help our coaches out there?
Well, so, you know, this is our third year for our organization. So a lot of this stuff, there's a lot of new things we're going to implement for the first time this year.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of those that we are going to implement are, number one, as an organization, we're not going to bunt very often, but it's not to say we won't bunt. But one of our big philosophies is we want hitters to go from first to third as often as they possibly can. And we talked to, he's a great coach in independent baseball, Mike Pinto, and he was talking to us about how they use this sort of like this funnel, this triangle for center fielders. So if a ball's hit far enough towards right or left center, where the center fielder, as he's charging the single, has to turn his hips, they're going to go first to third almost 100% of the time on that. Because absolutely, when the center fielder has to turn his hips, now his throw is going to have to be much more difficult to third base, where even an average runner is going to be safe there almost all the time. So that's just kind of like a, you know, one of these policies. But, you know, with other stat stuff, we just want to make sure that at the end of the season, we know who the best players are from lots of different angles. And we want to give parents and kids a valid reason whether we keep or cut their son, because it's not a decision we take lightly to let a young man go. And we want to make sure we have it right. So one of the other things we want to use is a little bit better fielding statistics. So fielding percentage it's very weak because it rewards you for fielding balls that you get to, but it doesn't take away from you if you have little to no range. So if you have a young man who stands at shortstop and he never moves and he only feels the balls that are hit right at him and he always makes the throw, he might only field, you know, 40 ground balls in a season. But if he fields all of them, his fielding percentage is 1,000. You say, wow, he's great. Whereas you could have another young man who has lots of range and he goes after stuff. He's aggressive. Say he makes 70 plays instead of 40, but he makes 10 errors. His fielding percentage is going to be much lower. You know, it's not going to be 1,000, but he also converted 20 more ground balls and fly balls into outs than the other person did. So you say, who's a more valuable fielder to my team? Is it the guy who never makes a mistake, but also never challenges himself? Or is it the guy who has a lot of range and is aggressive and he'll throw some more balls away? You know, he'll miss a couple more, but he also converts more overall, you know, batted balls into outs. And for us, we want the kid who's got range. And so there's a, you know, a stat that I think makes sense for us and for a lot of amateur coaches, which is called total range factor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really simple. It's just total assists plus total putouts. So you take that number, you divide that by the total amount of innings you play. So say you had 1,000 putouts and assists and you played 500 innings. You divide that, that's 2, and you time, you multiply that by your innings, and then you divide, I'm sorry, you divide it by your innings. So, you know, major leaguers, you get like 6.15 or something like that per 9 innings. So you know that over a given game, a really great shortstop is going to make 6 plays or so for you. And a lesser player might make 4, or you might make 3.25, something like that. But it's going to give you a better number. And I apologize for the listeners. I don't have the exact – the formula is very, very simple. I just don't have it clearly in my brain at this moment.
And that's okay. But here's the interesting part, Dan. Here's what I like about it. As you're talking about this, what I'm thinking about is this also gives young kids or players – the understanding that now they need to get better when it comes to range, how to get quicker, how to work on certain areas, so that way their fielding percentage changes according to these stats.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great point, because as a player, you have to understand what you're being evaluated on. And so all these major league clubs, so I know for fielding in the major leagues, UZR, or ultimate zone rating, mm-hmm. is the gold standard for fielders. And it's not a stat that the public really knows, but it's a stat that all the teams are using to determine who's the best fielders on the market. And that's a really complex equation. They chart every single ball, where it's hit and where it falls and where it's caught. And there's almost like a rating for every one that says, okay, you know, if a fielder can get to this ball on the very perimeter of what's even possible for a human being to get, then it's going to be worth more than the ground ball that's hit right at him. So it's a really complex equation that's not really appropriate for amateur baseball, but they put a huge premium on making premium plays in the majors. So not only do they rate you on just making all the routine plays, but you'll see a guy like Andrelton Simmons, who's widely, you know, seen as the best shortstop in the majors. You know, he makes plays that are maybe only made by 2% of all shortstops. You know, on a single blooper, maybe only 1 out of 100 times that ball is caught by a shortstop and Simmons might catch it, you know? So
Yeah. They're
really complex, but you don't have to have that much complexity at the youth level. You can just say, hey, we're going to calculate all the total putouts and assists. We're going to divide them by innings. And we're going to know that little Johnny, he makes 3 plays per 7 innings and Timmy makes 4.5 plays per 7 innings. So Timmy looks like our better shortstop, you know, as long as he's not making a million errors, something like that.
Right, right.
So,
that's what I like about the statistics part of it. It gets kids into the game also more. Now you and I talked about this. I want to go to the launch angle a little bit, and there's so many areas we could discuss, but you and I talked about it a little bit at the clinic in Illinois here. You know, launch angles obviously can be good for certain things. And what I want you to talk about is how launch angles can be misused especially at a very young age, with volunteer coaches or coaches that really don't understand it yet. Can that be misused? And, you know, what should they be concentrating on?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I played with a guy, and the higher up you get into baseball, whether it's college or professional, you start to fall into roles, right? So you're not going to see a big, slow, lumbering power hitter hitting in the one hole, right? You're going to see fast guys with better on-base percentages. They have to do a certain job when they're going to hit in the one slot or the two slot. Everyone sort of has their place. And so you don't want a player who is a one hole type hitter, you know, fast, smallish, on base type guy trying to be a power hitter, because he's going to fly out. So as we looked at some of this data and some of the stuff I presented was, look, if you hit the ball 100 miles per hour off the bat, which means you need to square the ball up really well, number one, and you need to swing the bat at least 90 miles per hour to hit a ball 100 miles per hour for the most part. So if you don't have absolutely premium bat speed and square the ball up all the time where you can hit the ball 100 miles per hour off your bat, you're going to fly out a lot of the time. So when you hit a ball 100 miles per hour at a 25-degree launch angle, so to say, so 25 to 35 is like the home run. It's like the doubles into home run launch angle. If you hit the ball 100 miles per hour at that launch angle, absolutely you should lift the ball, because you're going to get more bases for, you know, a given hit. But if you say hit the ball 90 miles per hour off the bat for the most part, which is what a good high school hitter will do, it's what a lesser college hitter will do. That same 25 degrees, it almost never makes it over the outfielder's head. And so then the higher launch angles, 30 degrees, 35 degrees, even more so, they just become long flyouts. Mm-hmm. And so unless you're hitting the ball with absolutely premium exit velocity, and you're talking like guys like Chris Bryant, you know, guys like, you know, Aaron Judge, you know, if you're not crushing the ball, then you shouldn't be lifting the ball too much because you're going to fly out a lot of the time. And so for young players who aren't hitting the ball well above the, you know, the league average, they're going to just end up popping a lot of balls up rather than focusing on hard contact and line drive. So if you look at a 90 mile per hour spray chart, if you hit the ball between 10 and 20 degrees of launch angle, so in that like 15 degree range, mm-hmm. if you hit the ball 90 miles per hour at a 15 degree launch angle, you're going to hit like 950 on the 90 foot, you know, big field. Because when you hit that line drive, it's always going to make it over the infield and it's always going to fall before the outfielders get to it. And so you say, all right, if this is what I can do, I can hit the ball 90 miles per hour off the bat. Why am I going to risk flying out all the time when I can just focus on hitting line drives and have an extremely high batting average? And then as I grow into my body and I get bigger and I get stronger, now I hit the ball 96, 97, I can lift a few more balls, you know, because they're going to get over their head. They're going to get into the gap a little bit better. And yeah, now, sure, you can start to use launch angle to your advantage. But, you know, the data seems pretty clear that the amateur level, if you're not way, you know, a couple standard deviations above what the average player swings in your level, you know, it could be 12U or 15U or whatever, you're just not going to hit the ball over their head enough to make it valuable.
Sure. So basically what we're saying in a phrase, we're saying the harder you hit the ball, the more the faster bat speed you have, exit speed you have, the little bit more launch angle you might have.
Absolutely.
Right. We're going. So now – and that's what I love about that. That's what I love about your talk, because when you look at on TV sometimes and guys talk about launch angle, you know, young kids can get the wrong impression. All of a sudden start swinging under, or, you know, because they think they got to lift it. Well, a lot of them already have a natural lift, an uppercut. We're trying to readjust that a little bit. So like you said, now we're hitting line drives. Now when we get into the defense and offense, and I know we only have about 10 minutes left, when we get the offense and defense, you know, when it comes to run expectancy and, you know, moving guys over, you mentioned, you know, that most likely, and you see it a lot in the game now, a lot of guys don't bunt, you know, especially early in the game, with nobody out, with a runner on first. Explain the statistics a little bit, but then also explain, how does a coach at a different level, let's say the youth level, or even some travel ball teams, how do they take some of these stats and use some common sense? Because a lot of times, and I'll give you a quick example, you go down to Dominican Republic, well, they don't work on bunting a lot. So if you're playing in a competitive game and you bunt, well, they're not very good on defensing it. So let's kind of open that up a little bit to our audience.
Yeah. So, you know, run expectancy is very simple. And this is actually one of my favorite things about sabermetrics, but there's 24 base out states. So a base out state is like first, a runner on first with no one out, or bases loaded and two outs. So it's how many runners are on base and how many outs there are. So there's 24 of them, and they have data from the major leagues that covers all these scenarios, so that we know when in the majors, with the bases loaded, no one out, your team's going to expect to score 2.3 runs on average, because they just average all, every time they're in that situation, they plug the rest of the innings result into it. And so we know that the value of an out is about double that of any single base. And so if you're in, say, first and second, which is a run expectancy, I don't have it in front of me, I think it's about 1.4 runs. If you then bunt those two runners to second and third, you're a little more likely to score one of those runs in that inning, which is run probability. Run probability just discusses how likely you are to score one run before the inning ends. Your run probability increases a little bit, maybe like 5%. But your run expectancy, how many you expect from that entire inning, it actually goes down. And it doesn't go down a lot, but it goes down enough to where you're asking yourself, why should I give up an out when I'm not expecting to score any more runs in that inning?
Right.
Now, so in the big leagues, you know, when they bunt, the outcome's relatively certain, right? So they bunt, they're out. And this only applies to sack bunts. So if you're bunting for a hit, that's different because your likelihood of getting on base is higher because you're going to be sneakier about it. You're probably a lot faster. You're probably bunting because the defense is maybe playing back on their heels or whatever. But with a sacrifice bunt where you're saying, I'm going to give myself up and you know that I'm going to do that, you're going to be out in the majors. But in the amateur level, it's not quite that certain, right? So there's no one, I'm not going to tell you don't bunt. Because at the amateur level, there's some merits, right? You could bunt just to keep the other defense on their toes. You know, you might show bunt with a really fast kid early, and now the team is on, you know, they're playing closer for the rest of the game maybe, and now some of your bigger guys hit the ball a little harder, a couple more balls get through because the defense had to play a little close to defend against the bunt. Also, if you know a team's got really sloppy defense, you might bunt and say, hey, if I sacrifice, no big deal, but I think they might throw this ball away or we might just beat it out or, you know, all those scenarios. So it's a little less clear at amateur levels, but I think the big take home message is if you're trying to give up an out for one base, you're giving the other team a gift because you only get so many outs. So at, you know, the amateur level, you get 21 of them, you know, 27 if you're playing obviously 9-inning games. You only get 21 outs for most amateur baseball. So when you're giving up one of those, you just really reduce the potential for a big inning and the potential for just more runs in any given inning. So unless it's, you know, like the 9th inning or the 8th inning and just coming down, okay, it's 2-1. We have a runner on second with no one out. Sure, you might want to bunt him to third because he will score more often from third with one out than from second with no outs. But if it's in the 4th inning and you're trying to break a game open, you're probably better off swinging away because you'll expect to score more runs in that inning the more outs you keep to yourself. You don't give away those outs.
That's interesting. And again, that's what I love about the science, you know, statistics, because you can actually take these statistics and use them as a general guideline. Coaches, you know, I would assume have to use some common sense as you're talking about looking at situations, deciding whether it's the proper time to do certain things, one, statistically, but two, also against who they're actually playing. Now, when it comes to statistics like this, where would be the top area that coaches should really focus on, look for when it comes to statistics? Would it be the offensive part? I mean, because you can get inundated with so much of this. Would it be the defensive statistics? Where would you start?
I think hitting for the following reason. Number one, I think it's still not very mainstream how important on-base percentage is. I think batting average is extremely overrated because batting average really only tells you how many hits you got in a certain amount of at-bats. But being on base, getting to first base without making an out is the most valuable transaction in baseball. And that's not my opinion. That's opinion of a lot of great sabermetricians. So if you read, you know, anything by like Tom Tango or Keith Law's book, Smart Baseball was a great book. It was the first one I read. I thought it was outstanding. But getting on base without getting out is the most important thing you can do as a base runner or as a hitter. So we have to understand that. And then when you start to understand that, you say, okay, if getting on first by any means necessary is the most valuable thing a runner can do, then it doesn't really matter if he hit a single or he walked or he got hit by a pitch. And then obviously every base you can add to that is a bonus. So you want to understand the value of stolen bases, right? So, you know, it's risky to steal bases in some situations versus others. And on the whole, you need to be successful about 70% of the time when you steal to break even, not to give your team value, but to break even because an out is so valuable. So, you know, risking that steal where you might cost your team an out, you got to make sure it's worth it. So like stealing third with two outs, absolutely not worth it. Right. But stealing second with no outs adds actually a pretty good boost to your probability of scoring at least a run that inning. So you just want to pick your and choose your times. And then as far as, you know, just assessing hitters and figuring out who you have, how much value they add to your team, you know, we're going to use a thing OPS, which is very simple. That is a mainstream stat. But it's better than batting average. You know, it's on base plus slugging. And it just gives you a little bit better look at how many extra base hits they get and how often they get to first base. So it's like batting average, but better. And because really you just want to make informed decisions about who you have in your lineup and where you have them in that lineup. So you can optimize, you know, when you get guys on base, you can optimize the likelihood of them scoring, you know, and you can make sure you stat or you pad your team with guys who are providing value for your squad. So you don't want to have, you know, a 300 hitter who hits 30 singles and 100 at bats. You'd rather have a guy who hits 250 but has 12 doubles and, you know, 13 singles, and also maybe he walks 15 times. You know, mm-hmm. like batting average is just, it just doesn't give you a good enough picture, yeah, as to what a hitter can do.
Wow, that's fantastic. Let me tell you, this has been an awesome show. Dan, I want you to end with this. We always try to do it with all our guests, you know, kind of, you know, speak to everybody that we have as an audience around the world, our coaches, our players, our parents, any last minute advice when it comes either to coaching or players or anything you just want to, you know, talk about that you want them to really understand. This is your time. You got a couple minutes here and then we'll finish the show.
Well, when I retired, I think the thing I was most thankful for was my parents. And if I have any advice to give out there for parents and coaches, it's don't push your son too hard. Make sure that he's playing for him. And the best thing that you can do when he's done at the end of the day is just tell him that you love him and that you're proud of him. It doesn't matter how he played. Tell him that you love him. Tell him that you're proud of him. You know, my parents always did that. And I just did not appreciate how important that was until I retired, because all the, you know, all the grit and all the resolve I had was because I could play the game without fear of anyone else getting on me or being disappointed in me. It was always for me. I played the game because I loved it. And the way my parents handled me in my career, the way they just let me play, they let me love the game. They never put any expectations, never any extra pressure on me. Because they did that, I had the strength to keep going through those surgeries, to keep trying to hold on to my childhood dreams. You know, that really was it's much more important than you realize. So, you know, don't worry if they didn't put in as much practice as they should have today. You know, don't worry if they maybe fell a little bit short. You know, always correct them if they're not being a good teammate, if they're not being a coachable student. But at the end of the day, baseball's fun. It's supposed to be fun, and they should love it because they love it, not because, you know, you want them to play. And even if you know, like, oh, he's got so much potential, if he just put in more work or if he just focused harder, I know he could be great. I know a lot of parents push their kids because of that, and that's an admirable goal. You want them. You can see, you know, that they're maybe not doing what they need to do. But even then, just support them. Just ask them if they want to go play catch a little more. Ask them if you want to go to the batting cage. And if they say no, just let them be kids. But, you know, at the end of the day, people are going to be only as good as they want to be. And it starts at childhood. And I wanted to be good. I didn't know what a work ethic was until I got to college. But when I figured it out, I put in all the work because I wanted to. And so I really think it just starts with parents and coaches. And if you guys just let your young man play, tell him you love him and tell him that you're proud of him, I think you'll have no idea how impactful that will be.
Great job, Dan. And if you want to reach out to Dan, at Coach Dan Blewett, BLEWETT. Also his website, danblewett.com. Get a hold of him, especially if you got a young player who's looking for a place to play or needs lessons or wants to just learn the game. Boy, you got to reach out to this guy because he knows his stuff. Dan, listen, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. It was a pleasure listening to you at the Illinois High School Clinic and also meeting you. Hope to see you soon again. And thanks for being on Baseball Outside the Box.
Yeah, thank you, Pete.
All right, to all our loyal listeners out there, thank you for listening. Don't forget, keep getting smarter like Dan does all the time. Educate yourself. Never expect to be just good. Be great at everything you do. Follow us on Twitter at Baseball Out, our website, Baseball Outside the Box, our Facebook, also Baseball Outside the Box. We've got a lot of great information. Do us a favor, spread the word out on social media. We've got videos, tips, everything on there. The more you spread the word, the more you join, the more the show just continues. My email info at Baseball Outside the Box. Don't forget to email me any questions, any comments, anything. We'll get right back to you. Special thanks to Brian Crock, our producer with the Lineup Media Group, and also our guest, Dan Blewett. And remember, coaches, education is the key to building the foundation of our sport. So keep getting smarter by listening to the show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds with innovative thoughts that love to challenge the status quo. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Have a great coaching day and see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.